stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey there, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. We are live on this Thursday afternoon, and we are waiting for your call to answer questions about the Catholic faith, especially those of you who are not Catholic. If you've got a question, love to especially hear from you today at 833-288-EWTN. Actually, anybody can call, but we're doing this special outreach for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com is the address. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phone screening. Ace McKay is on social media. He's keeping a weather eye on YouTube and Facebook. If you'd like to ask a question on YouTube anyway, you can put that in the chat screen. Ace will see that and he'll send it to us here in the studio. Again, it's 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Going to lead off today with a question we received overnight from the EWTN listener comment line.
I would like to know why we stop serving the blood in church. Jesus said, mass without the blood is no mass at all. We want back the blood in church. This is why the church is being weakened and a lot of members are leaving.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so much. So I found three things to respond to here. The first one was the question, why did we stop making the precious blood available to the laity in the church? So this is a tradition that goes deep, deep, deep into the Middle Ages. And as devotional awareness of the doctrine of the real presence began to blossom and flower in the Latin Church, the Western Church, mm-hmm. particularly after about the 9th century, evidenced by things like the Feast of Corpus Christi that is instituted, an equal awareness penetrated the minds of the faithful and of the church that the precious blood is also the body and blood of Christ, and unlike a consecrated host, it can be easily spilled.
Yes.
And to avoid the risk of scandal, it became not the norm to administer the precious blood to lay people. And that's, we're talking 1,000 years ago.
I mean, sure.
It's a very old tradition in the Latin Church.
Okay.
But the theology of Holy Communion and of the Mass indicates that there is no necessity for the laity to regularly receive the consecrated chalice. So as far as the doctrine of the real presence is concerned, the church teaches that the entirety of Christ's body and blood are present in the consecrated host as well as in the chalice. And so someone who has the idea that maybe I'm only getting half of Jesus or only half of communion has misunderstood the Catholic doctrine that says, no, you're getting the whole thing, right? In fact, if you take only the chalice, you're still getting the whole thing. And there are a few people with celiac disease who respond negatively to the accidents of bread and wine that remain after the consecration, and therefore they commune with the chalice only, right? And either way, you're getting the whole Christ. But you're also missing something else, which is why, after all, are there two kinds? Why not institute the sacrament of communion in just one kind? Jesus could have done that, just consecrate bread, just consecrate wine. He could have consecrated something else, a carrot, but he chose these elements, two of them. Why? And the reason has nothing to do with our act of communion, per se. It has to do with the meaning of the Mass at large, the sacrifice of the Mass, because body and blood, when represented by bread and wine, call to mind the crucifixion, because the blood's over here and the body's over there. They're in a state of separation. When you separate your body from your blood, you're dead. And so even though Christ is whole and entire under each species, when we see the two elements in their separate locations, it memorializes what happened at Calvary. And that's why the Mass is called the Memorial of Christ's Death and Resurrection. And it is that memorializing of Calvary that comes into play when we offer the elements to God in an act of sacrifice to which we join ourselves. And that function of the two kinds of consecrated species does not require the laity to commune at all. Like, if you go attend Holy Mass and you observe the consecration and you willingly offer yourself along with the body of Christ, you have fulfilled the logic of the Mass, the goal, the dynamism of the Mass, without receiving in either kind. So that's the why of it.
Okay.
Jesus said it's no Mass at all without the precious blood. No, he didn't. No, he didn't say that.
Somebody may have said it, but Jesus didn't.
Someone may have said that, but yeah. Jesus didn't say that.
Okay.
And Holy Mother Church does not say that. In fact, she says the opposite. And since Christ said of the Church that whatever she binds on earth will be bound in heaven, we can trust the judgment of the Church. The Church allows communion in one kind, and then communion in one kind is okay. Otherwise, the Church wouldn't allow it. The suggestion that it is because we have communion in one kind that the Church has been weakened and people are leaving— I don't think that bears historical scrutiny, because the fortunes of the Latin Church have risen and fallen numerically, like monumental explosive growth as well as decline, regardless of the question of communion in one kind or two. So in the world today, the Catholic Church is growing very rapidly in Africa and Asia,
yes,
shrinking in Europe and North America. Mm-hmm. They have the same rite of the Mass.
Sure do. Appreciate that. And thank you so much for your call to our listener comment line. Quick question here before we go to break. This came in from Anne Marie in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Did Jesus ever get sick?
Well, Jesus's body was certainly subject to corruption and death. Well, I won't say corruption, not rotting, because he rose from the dead. But you know what I mean. He was subject to physical ailment. If you cut him, he bled. He did, in fact, bleed copiously. You could kill him. And so I don't think there's any necessity to hold that his physical body during his earthly lifetime would have somehow been immune to, you know, the normal woes of human life. I mean, otherwise he wouldn't have been human, right?
Could have caught a cold.
Could have stubbed his toe, you know. What did Jesus say when he stubbed his toe? That's a good question.
Ow. Start with that. Anne Marie, thanks for checking in from Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Hey, lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. We're live on this Thursday afternoon on Call to Communion. Stay with us. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. We are live on this Thursday afternoon. Love to get a phone call from you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Some very good news for you, and that is EWTN radio programs are available on Spotify. Weekday shows from the Sunrise Morning Show through Ave Maria in the afternoon, plus the latest weekend programming. Find it all on the Spotify app. One more reason why EWTN is everywhere. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Linda, a first-time caller in the great New Orleans, listening on Catholic Community Media. Hello there, Linda. What's on your mind today?
I really would like to know what the Catholic Church's opinion is about reading near-death experiences books.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, to the best of my knowledge, there is no magisterial statement from the Pope or the bishops saying, here is our opinion on books about near-death experience. But we can extrapolate from what we know about Catholic dogma. There is doctrine in the Church about how should we treat claims to private revelation. And effectively, someone who claims to have died and met Jesus or seen angels or whatnot and then come back to life is making a claim to private revelation. And the first thing the Church says about that is that the content of any private revelation or alleged private revelation should never be made a matter of public proclamation by the Church as if it were a dogma. So one is not held, one cannot be held to believe it, right? That's principle number one. Number two is that such reports should be treated with skepticism. And under rare circumstances, the authority of the church might come in and say such a revelation is worthy of belief, but that's not the same thing as saying it's true. It's just saying that this hasn't been shown to be false to divine revelation anyway, and mm-hmm. it might be edifying, but mm-hmm. we're not saying it happened. We're just saying, okay, you're safe believing it for the time being, unless something else comes up. To the best of my knowledge, no authority in the church has ever done that, certainly not with respect to all claims to near-death experiences, but with any particular claim to near-death experience. Like, I mean, except maybe Lazarus, if he had something to say about it, you know. But you're not going to find that kind of statement. And so, based on those general principles, I'd say if somebody makes a claim to a near-death experience, our first response ought to be skepticism, and our settled conviction ought to be not to present this as if it were a truth of the faith, uh-huh. right? I'm going to extrapolate further. This is my own personal opinion.
Okay,
we shouldn't do theology based on it. Right. So I personally am extraordinarily skeptical of the kinds of books that say, I'm going to tell you what's heaven is like because I've talked to three people who went there. I think that's a very dangerous exercise. St. Paul tells us, eye has not seen, ear has not heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man what God has in store for those who love him. So, you know, just because, you know, Johnny claims to have gone there and gotten a new bicycle, I'm not going to trust Johnny. Right. Now, you know, I understand that there are some Catholic apologists that find this literature to be very useful. And I guess it is useful in the sense that there's a certain number of people who are going to hear these reports and find them persuasive and maybe be motivated to investigate the faith in consequence. You know, you could say the same thing about the movie The Exorcist. Warren Beatty wrote The Exorcist. Not Warren Beatty. What's his name?
You were right about Beatty.
Beatty's, it's not Warren.
Peter Blatty.
Blatty, yeah.
Yeah.
Wrote The Exorcist. And he actually wrote it. I mean, he was Catholic. He wrote it because he sort of wanted to motivate people to take the unseen world seriously. And, of course, he was affiliated with Georgetown and knew a lot of Jesuits. And apparently, according to anecdote, after the film came out, the Jesuits at Georgetown had never seen so much business, right? They motivated a lot of people to go to confession. So, I mean, I'm not going to knock that. That's good. But I'm hardly going to take The Exorcist as sort of my standard text for demonology to be offered in a seminary class. I mean, it's clearly fiction, right? Yet it did have the effect of motivating some people to go seek out the confessional. So, I'm sensitive to the pragmatic value of, you know, and the apologetical value of using this. I think we ought to do so with caution.
Okay. William Peter Blatty.
Peter Blatty.
Almost had it right. Linda, is that helpful for you?
Yes, you were very clear. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your call from New Orleans. That opens up a line for you right now, a couple of them, at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. We are live on this Thursday afternoon here on Call to Communion on EWTN. All right, we're going to go to Steve. He was our last caller on hold yesterday. Couldn't get him on then. Steve is listening to us in Florida on the Great Divine Mercy Radio. Hey there, Steve. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Anderson. Appreciate your service here. When Jesus was on the cross and he said, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." It seems like it might apply to maybe all of us. We are all fallen, and some in severe fallen nature where they just reject God all the way, but they are maybe blind, you know. So does that really apply to all of us in some way? I mean, I'm not trying to, get out of my sins and so forth, and you know, Jesus gives us, you know, the confessional and so forth for a, not to be slang, but a mulligan term, mulligan out of jail there. But at any rate,
I understand the question. Yeah, I got you. I appreciate the question. So I'm pretty sure that patricide is evil. I'm really not in doubt about that. I don't think I'm in ignorance about that. You know, and I could go down the list, and I'm sure we could come up with a bunch of things we'd agree on that's just fundamentally wrong. And there may be some cultural differences in terms of, you know, this or that particular vice is, you know, considered better or worse in different circumstances depending on your culture. But there's a kind of broad outline of things that I think. I mean, I don't know any cultures that valorize cowardice, for example, or patricide, for that matter.
Yeah. Right?
And so I do think there's things we could know about the moral truths, the moral reality. I mean, most civilizations have some kind of inherent sense of fairness, of equity. They may play that out differently depending on whether or not they're a society of orders or a more egalitarian society, but they still have a sense of fair dealing and equity. And so I don't know that I'd be persuaded to say that that all of us are just invincibly ignorant of everything. Now, clearly, the Catholic Church does think that there is such a category as invincible ignorance and that it does excuse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the good news is that at the end of the day, we're not the ones making that judgment. You know, God will be the one that judges souls and decides, you know, how ignorant was this person and how culpable was their fault. We do this all the time in a very pedestrian way. I mean, nobody's going to judge the 3-year-old with the same severity they judge the 30-year-old, right? You know, I mean, we're just not. And sometimes we might find a 30-year-old with the maturity of a 3-year-old, and we might evaluate those people differently depending on the extent to which we think that their immaturity is their own fault. Obviously, somebody that has a kind of congenital cognitive disorder, we're not going to judge as harshly as we judge somebody that made themselves willingly ignorant, knowingly ignorant, so they could indulge their passions. We're going to judge those people differently.
Steve, thanks so much for your phone call today. I'm glad you called back. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's time for your phone calls at 833-288-EWTN. We have a couple lines open right now, 833-288-3986. Rosemary is in St. Augustine, Florida, listening on YouTube this afternoon. Hey, Rosemary, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon.
Howdy.
What is on my mind is in the final judgment when Jesus when Jesus comes again, does purgatory no longer exist? That's a heavy one there. And then those that are in, that's really basically it, is that are we going to go to heaven? It says purgatory still exists, but we're not fully purified. Nothing pure goes. Nothing that is not pure.
I got you.
We'll go to heaven, right?
So, two things. First of all, it would seem that purgatory ceases to exist at the final judgment.
Okay.
We get our final verdict. It would not be the case that we go to heaven thereafter. If by heaven you mean up there and away from this material universe, because the Catholic doctrine is that we will actually get our bodies back, and that our eternity will be an embodied eternity. So it's not, you know, not the condition of the separated souls. When we think about going to heaven, we're thinking about the souls of the dead right now who are awaiting their bodies, but at the resurrection, we'll get our bodies back. So it won't be exactly going up there. It'll be staying down here, but a new down here with new bodies and a new heaven and a new earth.
Rosemary, is that helpful for you?
No, I'm sorry. I guess I wanted more of a yes or no.
Yeah. No purgatory. After Jesus comes back. Purgatory closed. Door shut. No more business.
Amen. This is a question among a priest who was contemplating in this when he mentioned us, and he is the question that he just one moment. The Catechism says clearly in 1031, as for lesser faults, we must leave that, and that there's a purifying fire. But that's for those in purgatory. That is for not when he comes again. Although it leaves some questions in his mind that it seems that those living at the time of the last judgment would never go to purgatory at all.
Okay, so that presumes that if you're worried about there being some sort of inequity there, well, this guy got purgatory for 10,000 years, and this guy got it for 30 seconds, right? That the temporal proportions work out the same way for separated souls. And I think we cannot judge that. So St. Thomas tells us that for the souls in purgatory, the souls in heaven, the souls in hell that don't have bodies, that they don't experience the passage of time in the same dimension that we do.
Okay.
And so I don't think you could evaluate it that way. Like, hey, I got off scot-free because I was alive when Jesus came back. No, you're still going to have purification if you need it.
Rosemary, thanks so much for your call from St. Augustine, Florida. Ever since becoming a Catholic, it's hard for me to say St. Augustine, you know, because I want to say St. Augustine.
St. Augustine.
But there it is. Anyway, we do thank you so much for your phone call. 833-288-EWTN is our phone number. Here is Lou in St. Louis, listening on the Great Covenant Network. Hey there, Lou, what's on your mind today?
Oh, greetings. Blessed Lent to all of you. We know that true ecumenism is very good. As a matter of fact, there's a program here in St. Louis that the Archdiocesan newspaper just wrote up where non-Jewish high school students, including many Catholic high school students, visit a synagogue, and Jewish high school students explain Judaism and the different objects in the synagogue to them. I think that's a wonderful instance of ecumenism that helps combat anti-Semitism. But can ecumenism devolve into indifferentism? And if it can, how can we tell? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So indifferentism is the doctrine that it does not matter what religion you belong to. And I think that most people who are engaged in ecumenism think it matters at some level, because if you didn't, then you would just leave your neighbor alone in his different religion, right? Why work to try to achieve some sort of unity?
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, yeah, I mean, if you don't have strong theological convictions about your own tradition, and you just see these as sociological phenomena that are moral, that are indifferent, and you bring that philosophy to your ecumenism, I guess sort of if you bring your indifferentism into the mix from the beginning, yeah, but I mean, I don't think there's anything about ecumenism per se that that is some sort of slippery slope to indifferentism. I mean, not at all. I mean, I think one of the best examples of ecumenism in the 20th century was Hans Urs von Balthasar, who wrote a very famous book on the theology of Karl Barth, and it was one Catholic's attempt to respond to Barthianism. He makes it very clear, I'm a Catholic in all of this, right? But I'm trying to give a charitable reading to what this guy has to say,
sure,
and then give a Catholic response to what I think his major points are. And it's often hailed. But I mean, like, you couldn't find two people that were more determinedly the thing that they were. I mean, Barth was a Reformed Protestant. Von Balthasar was a Catholic's Catholic. And yet they could have a very intelligent, engaged in deep and critical conversation about points of commonality and difference between their two traditions. So, yeah, I guess really depends on the one doing the ecumenism. If you are an indifferentist and you go into it for that reason, yeah, you're going to be an indifferentist. But if you're a convinced Catholic and your motivations are to follow the Pope and the Church that have advocated this ministry, then you're going to have a very different outcome.
Lou, thanks so much for checking in from St. Louis. Glad you're listening on Covenant Network. Here's a question now from an anonymous listener. How can we as Catholics claim that the Bible is a Catholic book if the Jewish people are responsible for giving us the Old Testament?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, first of all, the canon of the Bible that the Church receives is not the one that contemporary rabbinical Judaism holds to at all.
Right? Okay.
First of all, because our Bible contains the deuterocanonical texts that rabbinic Judaism rejects. Secondly, because our Bible contains the New Testament that rabbinic Judaism rejects. But as far as the Hebrew Bible and those texts that we have in common with the Jewish people, the Christian position is that Christianity is the fulfillment of the Hebrew prophets' expectation about the coming of the Messiah. And so, I mean, St. Paul makes this point very clearly that the Gentile church has been engrafted into Abraham's stock, that we are children of Abraham by faith, and honestly, that the rabbinical interpretation of the Old Testament is not the correct one, but Jesus' interpretation of the Old Testament is correct. That's why we follow Christ.
Amen. Thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we'll be talking with Rose in Kentucky, Ellen in Warwick, New York. A couple lines open for you as well. 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986. It is Called to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. Time for your phone call if you've got a question for him, and that would be 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-398-3986. Hey, one of our great EWTN radio partners needs to hear from you next week. Siouxland Catholic Radio, serving Sioux City and Storm Lake, Iowa, kicking off their spring drive on Tuesday. And hey, no matter where you live, don't forget to support your Catholic radio station. They make it possible for you to hear us. Let's get back to the phones now and talk with Rose in Kentucky, who's listening online, EWTN.com. Hey there, Rose. What's on your mind today? Rose in Kentucky, are you there?
Yes, I am. I can't hear you very well.
Go right ahead. You're on.
My question is, I was baptized and then I was confirmed, but I wasn't confirmed at age 13, 14. I was confirmed as an infant. Do I need to be confirmed again?
Okay, thanks, Rose. I really appreciate the question. Here, I'd like to know, do you happen to know what church you were confirmed in?
No, I was an infant, and I have been away from that area for 40 years.
Okay, the reason I ask is that there are rites of the Catholic Church in which chrismation, or the confirmation of infants, is the norm. The Eastern rites of the Catholic Church regularly do this, and it is a valid and licit way to perform the sacrament. So if a Catholic tells me that I was confirmed as an infant, my first inclination is to want to know, were your parents attending an Eastern rite Catholic Church at the time, or do you know? Were either of your parents from Eastern Europe or the Middle East by any chance, or any of your grandparents from that?
No, we're Spanish.
They're Spanish. So this, as far as you know, this was a Latin Rite church.
Mm-hmm. So, no.
Okay. And you know this about yourself, why? Because your parents told you that you were confirmed as an infant?
I'm really having trouble hearing you, and I don't know why.
I'm sorry. So how did you gain this information about your confirmation? Did your parents tell you?
Yes.
All right. I don't suppose they have a record of that sacrament, do they? Do they have any paperwork from
no,
the church?
I'm 86 years old.
You're 86, yeah.
And it just occurred to me.
Yeah,
I have my children, my grandchildren, they've all been confirmed at what we do now.
Yes, yes. So I don't know, other than being confirmed in an Eastern Rite Catholic Church, I don't know why a Latin Rite Church would do this, unless they thought you were somehow in danger of death. I don't know. Were you sickly as an infant? Do you have any knowledge of that?
I was baptized in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Albuquerque. Okay. So there is a Byzantine Catholic Church out there. I wonder if there's any possibility that your parents were attending a Byzantine community at that time, where that practice would have been normal. The only other thing I could think of is that maybe if they thought you were in danger of death, perhaps they wanted to admit you to as many sacraments of initiation as they could.
Would she have to be confirmed again?
No. If you were actually confirmed, then you would not need to have the sacrament again, right? It's valid applied to infants. I'm just trying to figure out why they would have done it.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the long and the short of it is that if you were validly confirmed as an infant, then you are fine and you don't have to have the sacrament done again.
Rose, thanks so much for your call today from Kentucky. Let's go now to Ellen, who's in Warwick, New York, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hello, Ellen. What's on your mind today?
Yes, I have a question about Arianism and the writings of St. John of Damascus as regarding Islam, because he worked for the Caliph, and he declared Islam as a heretical Christian gospel like Arianism. And I'm wondering what the Church's stand is on Islam now.
Yeah, sure. So the Church's position on Islam is that it is not Christianity. That's for sure.
At all.
And that Islam denies many of the dogmas of the Catholic faith, like the dogma of the Trinity. And so in that respect, Islam has that in common with Arianism. Now, as a matter of historical influence, most scholars are more inclined to see Nestorianism rather than specifically Arianism as the influence on Muhammad's thinking, as well as his Jewish period in Medina. The Jews of Medina were an influence on his religion as well. So there were Christians and Jews that did not hold Trinitarian dogma that he interacted with that may have an impact on his on his thinking. Now, it's typically not the practice of the Catholic Church today to apply the title heretic to people who have been brought up in a religion other than the Catholic Church, because as a canonical crime, heresy is the obstinate rejection of a dogma of the Catholic faith. And so it'd be hard pressed to say that, say, Muslims or Protestants are obstinate in their rejection of Catholic dogmatic claims because they weren't brought up Catholic. So it's not like they're not expected to know and understand the teaching of the Catholic faith. You know, their error is an honest one, it's a sincere one. So we would say they're wrong, they're erroneous. We don't typically call them heretics, but I mean, the substance of the thing is the same. Yes, do they deny dogmas of the faith? The answer is yes.
Okay, is that helpful for you, Ellen?
And where could I read more about this topic?
Do we have any books on Islam in the EWTN Religious Catalog?
I'm sure we do.
We probably do, and there's a pretty well-established scholar of the Arabic and Islamic world named Bernard Lewis, that I know that Father Pacwa likes to recommend, so okay. You might look there too.
Yeah, check that out. Go to EWTN.com and click on Shop, and hopefully you'll find something that will answer those questions for you. Ellen, thanks for checking in from Warwick, New York. It is called a Communion here on EWTN. We're live. We've got a couple lines open, and we can get a few more phone calls in today before we close up shop here. Here's a question we received from Byron. This came in an email on Monday. Byron says, what is the significance in the gospel when they say that people tore their garments? I keep hearing about this. Why would they do that? And then what would they do after they tore them?
Right. Tearing the garments is a sign of penitence or anger, right? I mean, you're just a heightened emotion. But I mean, in the Old Testament, it's, you know, tearing your garments and putting sackcloth on your head is a sign of penitence. But in the New Testament, you read the book of Acts, sometimes Paul will speak and he'll make everybody mad and they'll rip their garments. And the picture is not so much one of penitence, but more like, ever see a three-year-old get furiously angry and like try to rip their shirt off, you know?
I want to break something.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Or as Pedro and I were talking about right before the show, you know, Dr. Bannon, the Incredible Hulk, and the Avengers says, my secret is that I'm always angry. You know, rips off the shirt, big green monster underneath.
You don't want to see me angry.
Right.
I love that. Appreciate that. And Byron, thanks so much for your email. We'll continue with more calls in a moment. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here's a question from Enrique. Dr. Anders, in Matthew 5:19. Jesus says that whoever breaks even the least of the commandments of the law and teaches others to do so will be the least in the kingdom of heaven. So, how is it then that we are not supposed to follow the law? I know that he has just said that he has come to fulfill the law, but he doesn't say that we should not follow it because of his fulfillment of it. He seems to me to be saying the exact opposite. Explanations I've been taught seem like sophisms to me. I hope you can help. Best regards, Enrique.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So first of all, in the teaching of Jesus, Jesus was not indiscriminate in his endorsement of the law. Matthew 23, when he issues his woes against the Pharisees and the scribes, he says, you know, you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law, like love and justice and mercy. You should have done the latter without neglecting the former. So he doesn't admonish, he doesn't tell them to stop tithing mint, dill, and cumin.
Right.
He tells them that they're misaligning their priorities, and they're evaluating the one is more important than the other, and they're getting that all wrong, mm-hmm. right? There are other places in the Gospels where Christ seems to not hold to the letter of the law, like he doesn't hold to the Deuteronomic teaching that a man can divorce his wife for any reason. In John chapter 8, he doesn't want to follow through on the command to execute adulterers. So he definitely has a nuanced way of reading the sacred scriptures, but he does hold that they're the word of God. Now, the question that comes in the book of Acts and the letters of St. Paul is, do Gentile Christians have to follow the total law of Moses? And there was a group in the early church that said yes, tried to impose that on the Gentile church, mm-hmm. and St. Paul's position, which was vindicated by the Council of Jerusalem, was no, they don't. No, they don't. Christ himself did not go to the Gentiles. And he's very explicit about not going to the Gentiles. He says, no, I've been called to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So Christ only had a mission to the Jews, but the disciples, well, the apostles, had a mission to the Gentiles. And so there's a little bit going on there between, you know, Jesus' endorsement of the law within a Jewish context, where he still talks about things like temple sacrifice and worship, which, of course, is obviated by the destruction of the temple and the fact that today we're nearly an entirely Gentile church.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that email. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Tonight on The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, tonight's program, Dr. Walid Faris and Ghazal Sharmad, they'll be talking about the current state of the war with Iran and the people's uprising against the Islamist regime. Also, Gordon Chang on China's influence in Iran, Cuba, and other global hotspots, and whether there's any hope for Jimmy Lai's release from prison in Hong Kong. And if that were not enough, we've also got Noelle Mehring. She's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, talking about disturbing cultural trends, including no contact with family. Have you heard about this? Also, why some women are saying they regret having children. How sad is that? All this on tonight's program, The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN television and radio. All right, back to the phones now for Chris in Irvine, California, listening on the EWTN app. Hey there, Chris, what's on your mind today? Chris in Irvine, how are you?
How are you? Doctor, do you know, as a spirit, is your spirit and your soul, if your spirit and your soul is both in heaven, do you recognize others that are in heaven or not in heaven?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, first of all, remember that the final destiny of the human person is not disembodied. It is embodied. We look forward to the resurrection of the dead when you get your body back. And it will be recognizably your body. So it won't be exactly the same. It'll be transformed. But it'll still be recognizably you. I mean, Christ was recognizably Jesus by the apostles when they saw him after his resurrection. You will be recognizable as yourself by your physical appearance. What about the state of the separated souls? That is to say, the souls that do not yet have their bodies. Well, you clearly won't see one another because you don't have eyes. And if you did have eyes, it wouldn't be anything to see because you can't see something immaterial with material eyes. So there's no visual contact, no auditory contact, not that sort of thing. That doesn't mean you'll be unaware of one another's existence or presence, because even the separated souls will enjoy the vision of God, what we call the beatific vision, in which presumably they'll see all things.
Is that helpful for you, Chris?
Yes, but is your spirit there too, Doctor?
Yes, so Catholic theology doesn't distinguish, it does not have a tripartite anthropology. Some Protestants do, but Catholics don't. We have a dual anthropology where the human person is body and soul, and we don't distinguish soul and spirit as two different ontological entities.
Okay. Chris, thanks so much for your call from Irvine. Let's go to Marie now. Marie is in Boise, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Hello, Marie. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just something kind of off track a little bit, but a couple weeks ago was the Chinese New Year, and a neighbor of mine was sharing with me all the things she was doing to, you know, prepare for the Year of the Fire Horse, and I'm just curious what the Catholic Church stance is on that, like a gold coin for prosperity and situating things certain way for health. And is that, I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I want to be very cautious here in what I say. The church has a pretty clear teaching on superstition. And it basically is trying to manipulate the unseen world and animate forces that are, you know, beyond our ken for our own personal benefit. It has a pretty clear teaching on divination, fortune telling, which is you shouldn't do it. And so there are certain elements of, you know, traditional magical culture, whether they be Asian or American or European. And let me tell you something. There is no monopoly on superstition in Asia, right? I mean, there's plenty of it in the Western world, in the heart of the church even, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a celebrated historian named Keith Thomas who wrote a great book a number of years ago called Religion and the Decline of Magic, all about the role that magic played in popular culture in England, you know, up until the modern period. There's a great book in American history, and I think it's by a fellow by the name of Butler, and I'll think of it in a minute. But it's essentially on, it's a critique of the kind of Puritan-centric account of American religious history, as if Puritanism and mainstream Protestantism were kind of like the whole story. And he goes into this really in-depth ethnography to show the extent to which popular superstition,
really,
and you know, and beliefs in ghosts and spirits and you know, wise women and all this sorts of things were a really rampant part of American culture and continue to be to a certain extent. You know, the other day I was pulling out of the supermarket parking lot about 2 miles from my house and nudged my son in the gut and joked with him, to looked over next to us, and there was the local psychic or spiritist, you know, selling her wares. So, I mean, this kind of thing is ubiquitous throughout human history, and it continues to be even in the Bible-saturated, soaked, I mean, Bible belt doesn't hardly do justice to it. It's more like the Bible wetsuit down here, you know. And yet I've got the medium and the spiritist like 2 miles from my house, you know. So, yeah. I mean, like, this is not, it's not unique to one culture or another. And the church takes a dim view of all this kind of superstition, divination, fortune telling, what have you, right? Now, that's a different thing from saying, well, therefore, are we supposed to throw all non-Christian cultural traditions out the window? Obviously, that's not the case. Ever had a Christmas tree in your house? I'm guessing that you had, right? The church has always found a way to incorporate folk customs and traditions, even if they had explicitly pagan origins, into Christian identity. And it really falls to the judgment of the local ordinary, the bishops, to decide, you know, how much and to what extent of popular culture in any particular, you know, venue can be safely incorporated into Catholicism. And so, you know, I'd like to, but this kind of question would be something to take up with the Chinese bishops, quite honestly. Like, how do they negotiate that in their own cultural context? You know, there are some superstitions and maybe idolatrous practices that bishops wouldn't dare to touch with a 10-foot pole for fear of alienating everybody in their congregation. I'm thinking here of SEC football, right? You know, like, not going to touch that one. No way. No, that's the third rail, you know, there. Yeah. You know, so, you know, that's kind of my take.
Is that helpful for you, Marie?
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I enjoy your show. Thank you.
We appreciate you. Thanks for calling in from Boise. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Got a call from Linda in Michigan, listening on the EWTN app. She couldn't stay on the line, but she says, Dr. Anders, my Protestant son claims his church lives like the early church, which he claims were not Catholic, that the early church was not Catholic. Is he correct?
No, he's not. Now, he might live like early Christians in some respect. I mean, there might be some way. I mean, you know, actually, I was reading an article some time ago about archaeological finds in first century Galilee that were looking at, you know, shards of pottery, and they were doing DNA testing on some of the remnants to try to figure out what the diet was.
Really?
Yeah. And I think scholars have decided that first century Jews in Galilee, this was an innovation, actually probably wasn't the case a few centuries earlier, ate quiche.
What?
Yeah, they ate quiche. They baked eggs and vegetables in clay pots, and we can found some of the remnants of that archaeologically.
Wow.
So, I don't know, maybe he likes quiche.
Could be.
And if he likes quiche, he might find himself living in some respect like early Christians. I like quiche, don't eat it anymore, can't do the eggs, but, you know, I mean, like, that's... But somehow I think he's not what he has in mind, right?
Probably not.
My point is that there are accidental things he might have in common with early Christianity, but there are some fundamental differences. Number one, I'd like to ask him, where's his bishop? Where's his bishop? And where's his bishop that has apostolic succession?
Ah.
All right, so that's kind of the biggie right there.
Sure.
Where's his bishop with apostolic succession? And where is his valid Eucharist? And if he doesn't have those two things, then he clearly doesn't live like the early church.
Okay, then. Thanks so much for your question. Here is Therese now in Salem, Wisconsin, listening on the great WSFI. Hey, Therese, what's on your mind today?
Hi, my question is, how come in the Bible, Jesus and some of his disciples decided to change their names in some instances?
Yeah, to highlight their transformed identity. So most famously, Simon, who's also, well, Simon, has his name changed to Peter, which means rock, because Christ intends to make of him the rock foundation of the church's unity. So his new name reflects his new function and his new identity.
Okay. Therese, thanks so much for checking in from Salem, Wisconsin. Got a call from Mary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She called in, couldn't hold on, but her question is, what can I do about the fact that no one is dressing appropriately to Mass?
Hmm. Well, probably not much, to be honest with you. Probably not much. You know, you can always make your concerns known to your pastor and then consider that you have done what you can do and wash your hands of it, and then, you know, look to your own soul, right? Honestly, I mean, Christ tells us to take the log out of our own eye rather than the splinter out of our neighbor's. It doesn't mean that we can't admonish sinners on occasion, but we need to know that it's a serious business and that they're likely to listen to us and that we're the best person to make that admonition. When it comes to coming dressed immodestly to Mass, I won't be the judge of how serious that infraction is. I'd rather not see. I don't want to know that one, you know. but with respect to are they going to listen, if you say something, the odds are almost certainly not. Are you the best person to make the admonition? Probably not. If anybody is to make the admonition, it ought to be the pastor. If that somehow escaped him and you feel like you should tell him that, you certainly can do that. I mean, the canon law tells us that the faithful have a right and sometimes a duty to make their spiritual concerns known to the pastors. But then you have to leave it in his judgment. Let him do with it what he does. And if you're not satisfied with his response, then, you know, that's, you just have to be okay. He's the decider. And, we're, you know, I'm not the pastor of my church. I don't get to decide how we conduct the liturgy. The pastor does that. And you have to be okay with that.
Appreciate your call from Grand Rapids today, Mary, and thank you for listening to EWTN's Call to Communion. Question here from Esmeralda, who emailed us this. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, what does it mean when it says we can only pray to the Father through Jesus?
Yeah, so apart from Christ, we don't even know that God is Father, right? This is not a title that the faithful use of God in the Old Testament. Christ addresses God as Father, reveals God to us as Father, specifically the Father, the first person of the Trinity, and then invites us into his filial relationship with God. So we stand in relationship to God as sons and daughters only because we have been adopted into Christ, who is the eternal Son of God.
Okay. Thanks so much for that email, Esmeralda. TD is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. TD says, were the desert mothers and fathers Catholic?
Well, certainly they were. Certainly they were. Now, you know, since the 11th century, Catholics in the East and Catholics in the West have split, gone their separate ways, although both traditions lay claim to the patrimony of the first 1,000 years. So Orthodoxy and Catholicism both lay claim to that common patrimony, something that we absolutely shared in common 4,000 years.
Sure.
So if you say, were they Catholic, they would have called themselves Catholic. If you ask them, were they Orthodox, they would have called themselves Orthodox. And the question, you know, were they one or the other, wouldn't have made any sense to them in the 4th century or the 3rd century. Today we can quibble about, well, they're our guys or they're your guys, but they're really all our guys. And sure. Catholic in the broadest sense of the term of being universal and part of the patrimony of the Catholic and Orthodox tradition, that they are.
TD, thanks for watching us today on YouTube. We'll probably close with this one from Nora. Are angels outside of time or are they affected by time?
Okay, so according to the teaching of Catholic theology, angels are not eternal. They are not, they don't experience God's atemporality, but neither do they fully participate in our experiences of temporality because they don't have bodies. So they're not spatio-temporal beings in the same way that we are. So they occupy some sort of intermediate stage between eternity and temporality that the scholastic theologians called aveternity. Avum.
Avum.
Yeah, A-E-V-U-M or A-V-E-R-T. turn, I-T-Y, you know.
Okay.
A of eternity, yeah. So it's kind of, they sort of split the difference between the temporal and the eternal.
Very good. Nora, thanks so much for your email. And sure enough, here comes the music. Timed it out just right. Hey, Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
Keep it right here on EWTN, your Lenten companion. We have wonderful programming standing by, ready to bring you from now all the way through Lent, Holy Week, the Triduum, Easter, on into the Divine Mercy Sunday. Lots great ahead right here on EWTN. If you'd like to know more, go to EWTN.com and then click on the button where it says Listen. That's our hangout. And don't forget, you can check out at that same location a recording of today's program. Pedro will have that up for you in a couple of hours. On behalf of our great team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. See you tomorrow on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a wonderful day and God bless.